All right. Well, thank you for your questions. I appreciate it. It's always interesting for me to see what's on your mind and in some of these practices. So I sometimes have a hard time figuring out where I want to begin. So it's probably best to just begin at the beginning. And so if we look at what I said earlier, that there's really two components to practicing Dharma, and that sometimes they're broken down into mindfulness practices and heart practices is the two schools of that thinking. And so that we look at mindfulness practice, or what's known as Satipatthana, and that there's the four foundations of mindfulness. And in the early Buddhist tradition, it's understood that the four foundations of mindfulness lead to the direct path of liberation. And many teachers just teach mindfulness. They don't teach heart practices because they believe if applied in practice, that the fruition of mindfulness, the establishment of the four foundations of mindfulness, actually lead to these Brahma-viharas. They lead to kindness and friendliness and compassion and appreciation. So that's one school of thinking. And then there is this development of the heart or intention, the actual practice of saying these phrases. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with heart practices where you intentionally offer these phrases and these images in this sense to inspire or to encourage these types of states. Ironically, whether you practice mindfulness or the heart practices, they both lead to the same experience. And that's the experience of equanimity, which is the full awakening of the heart arrives in equanimity. And in classic mindfulness practice, the seven factors of awakening, the seventh factor of awakening brings us into the experience of equanimity. And so equanimity is a term that we don't throw around every day. But equanimity basically means that we see the both and of life. It's actually what DBT is based on. And that's the reality that life is both beautiful and tragic. There's joy and there's sorrow. There's praise and there's blame. There's gain and there's loss. There's pleasure and there's pain. There's these kind of polarized ways in which reality unfolds. And so that we want to be able to, A, understand that's how it is here for everybody. And we want to be able to respond appropriately in those conditions. And so this is where it gets complex, because we could say that mindfulness practice has different functions on different occasions for different purposes. And so it gets complex really quickly. And so my perspective and what I've recognized over the years is I teach both mindfulness practices and the cultivation of the heart in a way that's meant to be integrated, which is known as metta vipassana, which is the one of the first practices that I learned in my first teacher, Stephen Smith, who lives in Thailand, who was actually the last Westerner who was ordained by Mahasi Sayadaw. So he has a deep, deep lineage in the Burmese tradition, Mahasi Sayadaw, Sayadaw Upandita. And these practices were really meant to bring the metta into vipassana, so that way when we started practicing, we recognize and acknowledge this desire to be free, or we recognize and acknowledge this sense of being kind and friendly to ourselves, that actually bringing that right into the foundation of all the practices that we do was a very efficient way to practice. So I, you know, have given this talk many times, and when I teach retreats and I work with students, this is the system that I use, because I feel it's kind of nice to double dip. If the foundations of mindfulness lead to equanimity and so do the heart practices, let's just do them both. And also too, on some of the other stuff that I've studied around emotions, and my scientific interest has been in emotions. I'm very interested in emotions from a Buddhist perspective and from the perspective of science. And for the subjective reason that, if I'm honest, the suffering that I've experienced in life and the ways in which I continue to suffer the most is definitely in the emotional domain. I don't have a lot of suffering in my body. I can deal with heat and coldness and tiredness. I actually don't suffer so much in my thinking mind. I don't have a lot of anxiety. Don't have a lot of afflictive mental patterns that get me so much. But emotions? Whew. Now we're talking about some very destructive and difficult, and that's where for me, I've noticed suffering is the most difficult for me to manage or to overcome. So I'm very interested in being free from that. And I have found that metta vipassana is a really efficient way to go about dealing with the emotional experience. And also, Buddhism doesn't do a great job. Early Buddhism and Satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness, they don't do a great job of really addressing what an emotion is. It's probably most associated to this word you might know called citta, where the Buddha talks about the development of citta. In Tibetan Buddhism, they call it bodhicitta. And really what that is how do we cultivate constructive emotions or wholesome emotions? So all of the Brahmaviharas essentially are forms of citta. My teacher, Stephen Smith, calls them beautiful spiritual emotions. And this is the Buddha's articulation of saying, this as human beings is the best that we can expect. The best that we can expect, the best that we can do, is to try to bring an attitude of kindness and friendliness to all of our experience. It's in your best interest. And I currently am very suspicious to say this, but I'll say it. I actually currently believe that kindness is like magic. It just really, really disarms people. Right? If I'm in a bad mood and somebody just comes up and starts blasting me with kindness, I just kind of relax. I just can't but help. Right? So we are being encouraged to cultivate that. And there's not a choice in the mind. You don't just choose to be kind. And that's a component of it. You have to value it. You have to consider and be considerate and reflect and say, is kindness even something that I value, that I think is important? It starts there, but then you don't just switch that on and just be kind from now on. You have to cultivate that in your meditative experience. And, you know, the neuroscientists actually are saying that you can. And that this region, the left region, the prefrontal cortex, actually lights up in these positive emotions, and it actually cools the amygdala down. And the amygdala is the gateway to destructive emotions. And people with traumatic stress, they have a highly activated amygdala. So if you are amygdala driven, you have a larger boulder to push up the mountain. And as somebody who's been pushing the large boulder up the mountain for a long time now, I have a lot of compassion and understanding for people who deal with that, because it's a very difficult thing to manage. And so when we try to look at it again, I try to unpack these things to respect the complexity of what we're dealing with, but also like to bring it back to like, okay, like, what can we do? So when we really start to train the mind, again, we start, if we look at the foundations of mindfulness, it's very beneficial for many reasons to learn how to bring attention into the direct experience of the body and the breath. In fact, that being mindful of breathing actually will regulate your emotional system. And so just being able to have tolerance towards any difficult experience, which is a very valuable skill, and it's a skill that most people can't do. To be able to just come into a room like this and to be able to just sit quietly by yourself with your eyes closed and pay attention to your breath without getting aggravated or bored or thinking this is the stupidest thing I've ever been asked to do, that right there is very challenging. Like, we could go over to the main street tomorrow morning or Monday morning when people are walking around and grab some person off the street and just pull them in here and say, what I'd like you to do, sir, is just have a seat right here. Just close your eyes. Just breathe and know you're breathing. I'm going to come back and check on you in about a half an hour and we'll see how it goes. How do you think that experiment is going to go? I forget who it was, but one 17th century French philosopher said that all human misery stems from the fact that we can't sit quietly in a room by ourselves. Think about that. And again, this is what the Buddha is pointing out, is that in this, something about this psycho-emotional experience and the way that we project views onto the world, views onto ourselves, and that we do have these destructive emotions that we seem to not be able to manage, is that we create and that we imagine and that we actually manufacture misery and that we create unnecessary suffering for ourselves in our mind, heart, body system. And this happens to people. Everybody, it's very hard for people to not hear what I just said and go, oh yeah. And then of course you're probably self-diagnosing yourself right now, right? Like, oh yeah, wow, why do I do that? I should just stop doing that. It's not that easy. But if we understand that the system of training that we can engage in to really eradicate that experience, or at least alleviate that in the process, again, is a very attractive idea to most people, regardless of where it comes from. So all Buddhism and Dharma aside, the fact that there's something about our biological system in a way in which we can train our attention and our intention to lead us in that direction is very humanistic as far as I'm concerned. And so because the Buddhist tradition is rich with meditative training, they've kind of done the best job of sorting out what I just said. So that's sort of how we end up in these conversations. So again, as we sit and practice, as we're able to bring our awareness, our attention into the present moment, and really just tolerate the mind-body system, you actually, in that moment, you're cultivating the basic skills. You're cultivating the first foundation of mindfulness by being embodied, by letting the pace of your attention go no faster than the in and out breath. That's about how fast life is. How fast is the in breath and the out breath? That's life. That's how fast it goes. Birth, old age, sickness, and death. How fast does the mind go? It's just running circles, lapping the breath constantly. And what are you paying attention to more? This or this? And when pushed, you're like, oh gee, which one should I pay attention to? Oh, this one. So interesting for some crazy. I'm so fascinated with my suffering, I just can't stop. Like I'm addicted to it. I love suffering. It's so amazing and interesting and dramatic, and I can't believe it. And then we see that there's this other thing. And then, you know, the Buddha kind of pulls the rug out from underneath us. And says, you know, again, and equanimity is about the middleness is there, and the equanimity, the Pali term upekkha, is translated as there in the middleness. And here we are in the middle. And I love this idea, too, of the middle way, of being there in the middleness. Because I don't know about you, but my mind is always, not always, but often kind of landing in this perspective. I always feel like I'm in the middle of something. Like right now, I'm in the middle of this event, right? I'm in the middle of my day. I'm in the middle of my week. I'm in the middle of an argument with my girlfriend. I'm always feeling like I'm in the middle of something. I can't talk right now. I'm in the middle of something. I'm in the middle of this email. I'm in the middle. I'm always in the middle. How are you in the middle? Not so good. Stressed out. Anxious. I'm in the middle. Why am I in the middle? Because they didn't do what they were supposed to do. Now I got to deal with the bullshit that they didn't deal with. So again, as we become more embodied with our direct experience, we want to be able to cultivate metta. Kind friendliness. Metta translates as friendly. You might know this term if you have any Buddhist understanding. There's this term Kalyanamitta they talk about often, which is translated as like good friend or spiritual friend, or like, you know, our fellow people on the path with us. Mitta comes as the basis of the word metta, which means friend. And so how do we be friendly? That's my question. Well, pay attention to your breath, but be friendly. I'm like, well, how do you be friendly? My mind's not friendly. How do you be friendly when you're not friendly? Right? So if we want to put it in an actionable item, which I always find to be helpful, is it's to attend with interest. It's to pay attention with interest. That's what friendliness is. Why do you like to have coffee with your friend? Because when you have coffee with your friend or you have a meal with your friend, they pay attention to you and they're interested. Have you ever had anybody pay attention to you and be interested in what you're saying? Have you ever noticed how nice that feels? Somebody to give you to be generous enough, if we're lucky enough in this world, for somebody to listen to us talk without looking at their phone, right? That's metta. I'm with you. I hear you. I'm giving you my attention. How do we do that internally? Because I know that for me, when I come into my internal experience, there's a lot of things I'm not interested in sadness. You know, I'm not interested in sadness or any of the stories associated with that. I'm not going there. I don't do sadness. I don't do shame. I don't do disappointment. I don't do betrayal, and don't even get me started about abandonment. I don't do any of that. We don't talk about that shit. So there's these, a lot of our times our suffering are the experiences that we need to actually come to terms with or work with, we kind of banish from existence. But what do? They just lurk right below the surface of conscious awareness. Right there. And it's just like, nope, 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 nope. And so we develop strategies, whether they're behavioral strategies of eating, drinking, sexual activity, digital distraction, to avoid those aspects of our experience. Or we develop psychological strategies of becoming a control freak or thinking too much about everything all the time or minimizing or being in denial. In Buddhism, they call that ignorance, which is kind of a derogatory term, I think. I prefer the term denial. And maybe that's my substance abuse counseling profession kicking in. But denial is a good word, because what it means is that, and it works really well, I think, in this paradigm, because there are things about myself that I completely know are true that I like to pretend aren't true. That's denial. And so that we rationalize and we minimize and we justify and we pretend like everything's cool. Hey man, that happened 20 years ago. I'm over it. Totally cool with my past. No regrets about anything that happened. Don't feel disappointed about anything. Everything happens for a reason. That shit makes me crazy. People say, I have no regrets. I'm like, you have no regret? You are a sociopath. Or you're just so full of shit. I don't know which is worse. But we all engage in this type of experience, don't we? We all kind of know this is true. And again, one of the reasons why I'm so interested in emotions is that one of the things that I've noticed in my experience is when I become activated in some sort of an activated state where I feel overly stressed out, or I feel like I'm suffering, one thing I've recognized is that almost all of the time there's some sort of an emotional engine that's driving that experience for me. And it's usually some emotional experience that I'm not interested in. I'm very interested in how I can get it to go away. Very interested in that. I'm very interested in that. How do I not feel this? And usually what happens is I have to engage in some strategy, whether it's behavioral or psychological, to avoid change or control that which is lurking below the surface. And it just kind of gains momentum. And a lot of times these things come out sideways, don't they? So what happens, I've noticed, in the landscape of metta vipassana is that I can cultivate a present time awareness that makes me feel to some degree biologically safe. So I feel regulated in my system and I feel good enough. And if I'm actually able to enact or to cultivate an attitude of kindness, that all these difficult aspects of my experience all of a sudden feel like they have permission to arise. And as these experiences have permission to arise, I also gain access to the emotional component that lies below those. And now I'm actually able to work with some of these experiences in real time because I'm not trying to hold them off. And so I might have more awareness of, oh, I am disappointed, actually. Actually, I'm disappointed and I'm actually really quite sad about this thing that happened last week or 10 years ago. And I just never let myself have that experience. And now that that's allowed into my system, I can practice with that because I'm allowing it and I'm kind of saying it's okay for this to be true. And then we're working very pragmatically because A, we're training our attention to be with what is, but we're also creating, and it's a little more elusive. Attention's a lot more obvious. Attention is essentially about location. Pay attention to your breath. When your mind wanders, bring yourself back to the breath. That's location. And that's really, really valuable, but that's only half of the game. It's as I stabilize my awareness in that attention with some degree of benevolence, what arises in the space between that? Because if difficult emotions or memories or challenges arise within that space, we typically will shut that down. And so that the benevolence or the kindness, the metta quality, we kind of say, well, no, let's let this in for just a moment. Maybe this isn't so bad. Maybe I can do this. Maybe just for like a breath. I breathe in one breath of sadness. It's a long breath. For many of us, I know for me it was a very long, long in-breath. It's like, oh, it's not going to kill me. And so if this is just the foundation, of course, this is only the beginning of the conversation, this becomes the foundation for practice, whether you're sitting every day. But this kind of perspective is where we want to go, and this is the basis, the building block of metta vipassana. And so when we look at vipassana as a practice, the whole Buddhist paradigm rests in the Buddha acknowledging and pointing out that there's three characteristics to experience. There's three things that you can essentially count on, sometimes called the three characteristics or the three marks of existence, which is kind of like academic Buddhism 101. And they're very basic. It's that everything is impermanent, the reality of constant change. Because everything is impermanent, there's unreliability or there's dukkha. So there's anicca, impermanence, dukkha, difficulty, change. Because everything's changing, there's something about life that seems challenging. Have you noticed that life seems a little more challenging than it should be? That's dukkha. That shit's real. And it's here to stay. And the reality of anatta, that there's... none of it's personal. And so as we move through these three characteristics, that each one's a little bit more challenging to deal with, like change. Like we could grab that same guy I mentioned who we're going to bring in here and ask him to meditate. We could ask him and go, do things change? Does everything change? You could ask anybody that question on the street and probably 9 out of 10 people go, yeah, totally, things change. Everything changes. Yeah, totally, I know that. Everybody knows that. That's not difficult concept to cognize. But this is where Buddhism really ups the game. Is knowing that is true, does that have any effect on how you behave when you're actually dealing with change? When somebody that you love actually dies tragically, do you go to yourself, well, yeah, impermanence, I mean, totally. That's how it is. If people totally die, I'm totally at ease with that. I lost my job, you know? Oh yeah, change, totally. Guess they just want me to clean out my desk now. Cool, I guess that's just happening now. Totally fine with that, change. So, you know, it's interesting that we can understand something so poignant and in such a very clear, obvious way, but when we actually are experiencing it in a way that's got a strong sting to it, we don't, excuse me.
we don't have metta in that moment. We don't feel at ease. We don't feel kind. Because mostly we haven't cultivated that. We don't have access to that. That's not available. We don't have a whole store bank of that that we can draw from. And this is, again, where it gets complex, because there's different types of metta on different types of occasions. If I just found out that somebody that I really love and care about died, that metta wants to be calling to mind compassion. So in the face of change and loss, and real loss, and real pain, and real anguish, that the method is not just kindness and friendliness. It needs to be rooted in that, but it needs to call up Karuna. It needs to say, oh, this is. I need compassion right now. Compassion is what's necessary in this particular moment. And again, if we haven't been cultivating that, if we don't have any repertoire or fluency in that language, it's going to be very hard to call that up when we need it, especially when the stakes are high. Because I'm sure, like me, like all of you, I'm sure you can give me several examples of times in your life where it would have been real nice to have some of that compassion. And then on the other side of the coin, if I'm at my friend's wedding, who I love and care about and I'm happy for him, I don't need to be compassionate. I need to be appreciative. So that metta will take on a different type of quality in that kind of experience. I'm at somebody's wedding. My friend found the partner of his life, they're getting married, they're going to have this good life. I want to be able to participate in that goodness and that joy. And gratitude and appreciation is oftentimes very difficult because we feel envious. Am I able to rejoice and be happy at this friend's event, or am I jealous that I'm not married? Shit, I've been divorced. You know, it's weird when you go to your, I don't know if anybody here they've been divorced, but when you go to your first wedding after your divorce, it's a little weird. It's hard to have that appreciation, right? Because what happens in that moment? I'm not filled with appreciation for my friend. I'm too busy feeling disappointed about the loss of my marriage and my divorce because I haven't dealt with that. And so that pestering event shows up. And then I get kind of blown up. I'm like, well, now I feel bad because I'm at my friend's wedding and I don't feel appreciative. In fact, I feel disappointed about my loss, and then I feel jealous that they're having this marriage, and how come I'm alone? And I can't even drink at the wedding now because I'm an alcoholic. And fuck this, I'm out of here. How long would it take for that to happen? All of 8 seconds? So you see? These events, man, they happen quick and they happen fast, and we're mostly not prepared. So when we start to integrate mindfulness into the heart practices, we just start by bringing this benevolence and this kindness into an embodied awareness. And if that's all you did every day for a couple of years, that'd be great. That would serve you quite well. And then so again, we open up to these, in the second foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha asks us to be aware of these feeling tones and these impressions, the reality of pleasure and pain. And again, that's where the compassion and the appreciation are polarized. In the Abhidharma, the teachings on Buddhist psychology, the Buddha calls them illimitables. That these are mental factors, they're illimitable. Because there's no end to the amount of suffering that humans can experience. And there's also no end to the amount of compassion that we can cultivate in response to that. You know, I feel in my subjective reality that I've, you know, in times of my life feel like, why do all these bad things happen to me and how come I've been through so much difficulty? But then I look at the world and there's been a lot of people in a lot of places and circumstances who've been through a lot worse shit than I've been through. So there is an illimitable, there's no end to the amount of compassion one can cultivate. And there's also no end to the amount of appreciation one can cultivate. It's illimitable. Right? And we wouldn't have gratitude for suffering or unpleasantness. That wouldn't be the right occasion. We want to be able to have compassion for that experience. So
where an unpleasant difficulty, loss, pain, anguish experience, that metta needs to be able to call to mind compassion. Just like on the other side of that equation, we want to be able to call to mind, the metta wants to be able to call to mind appreciation and gratitude when that is an appropriate occasion. And isn't it safe to assume or to say that life is going to continue to keep throwing these various conditions at you? So the practice cannot be reduced to just one thing. The foundation would be this kind awareness, this metta vipassana, but it needs to be able to adapt to the conditions that we're in whilst we're in them. And in secular terms, that they would call that emotional resilience, that we become resilient, we become able to adapt to change, and we're able to get through these episodic events in our lives in a way where we don't create unnecessary suffering for ourselves in those experiences, but they're still painful. The loss of a loved one, losing of a job, financial insecurity, old age, sickness, those things are always going to present a level of challenge. And this is why the Buddha says all things are dukkha. There's a difficulty that we are just going to have to understand. We're always going to have to be willing to confront. So these practices, they give us resiliency, but they also prepare us for all of these realities. So everything is changing. Because everything is changing, things are unreliable, they're difficult, they're uncertain. There's no absolute. There's no black and white. Sometimes it's like this, sometimes it's like that. Sometimes you get what you want, sometimes you don't get what you want. Sometimes people do what they say they'll do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes you say what you're going to do and you have follow through, sometimes you do not. Is that ever going to stop? No, so we want to be fluent in these different types of experiential practices or these experiential languages, so that way when we find ourselves in these complicated territories, we feel like we have resources that we can draw on. You know, just sometimes dukkha is translated as stress, which I think is a really good translation. Because we wouldn't say, it wouldn't be fair to say life is suffering, right? I don't think that's very accurate. But would we say life is stressful? Life is stressful. And when does stress turn into suffering? Stress turns into suffering in any circumstance or moment where I feel like I don't have the internal resources to meet the external demands. And if I'm in a situation where the external demands are high and I don't feel like I have any resources, man, I suffer. So as we cultivate these various aspects of mindfulness and heart practices, we're actually cultivating and establishing internal resources that we can use when we need them. And again, I think for me, that's a very attractive idea. That actually sounds right. I'm like, yeah, that sounds, say that again, professor, that's a good hypothesis. I like that one. But then again, these internal resources, they're not choices that you make. You don't just decide to have internal resources all of a sudden. And you have that right view. The Buddha talks about right view. Is yes, you can maybe identify what I'm saying and kind of go, okay, that sounds right, but that needs to be followed through with intention. It needs to be followed through with action, and it needs to be something that we actually cultivate. And then again, if we kind of follow this all the way down, if we follow the trail of breadcrumbs all the way to the house, we end up in this experience of equanimity. Where A, we cognitively understand that life is both and, which sometimes is hard. I don't know about you, but when I get in an activated state, I go quickly to either or. Either you're for me or you're against me. Either I make good choices or I make bad choices. Either you love me or you don't love me. It's just like, anytime I notice I go into that paradigm, I'm like, I just know, yellow flag. I'm like, my mind is downloading bad information.
So then I go, no, it's not that simple. It's not this or that. It says there's an other. What's the other? I don't know, but I'm going to find out. And that's that equanimity of knowing that things are both and. And then being able to actually navigate the complexity at any given moment to how that will work out. And so I also feel Dharma practice is, and meditation practice, or however you hold that idea, it's just something we want to be, we just want to be good enough. You know? And this whole idea, and I've been teaching meditation classes for years, and probably taught thousands of classes. At one point I was teaching 300 classes a year. One of the things that I've noticed that I'm very interested in is when people are in the room like this, one of the things that really, really makes a mess of everything is the idea that I'm not doing this right. I can't meditate. Or that while you're meditating, this isn't going right. I'm not doing that right. Am I with the breath? He said the breath, but then he said hear the sound and to be kind, but I'm not really being very kind. I'm mostly just thinking right now. I don't think I'm supposed to be thinking. But I'm still thinking. I wish I could. I need to stop thinking, but I can't stop thinking. And I just think I'm going to go over there and have another one of those cookies because they were so good. But, you know, that happens, doesn't it? So we just have to go back and reset. We have to be very, very realistic about the fact that present time awareness does not guarantee pleasant time awareness. And that's what makes it so damn hard. You're like, well, this doesn't feel good. I read the mindfulness research thing on the internet the other day, and they said that you would be peaceful and be emotionally regulated if you did mindfulness practices, and I'm not feeling that way at all. Do not read any articles on the scientific benefits of meditation, because then you will expect to experience them while you're meditating. This is really actually quite painful and unpleasant, and I'm just thinking all the time. I mean, I came all the way over here, I drove over here, I read the thing, the guy was supposed to be pretty good, but I don't know about that. It's so funny, isn't it? Because that's what happens. Like, the Buddha calls that papancha. It's just mental proliferation. And so, again, oftentimes we find ourselves dealing with a steep learning curve on having to do that. So how we practice, Buddhist practice offers these objective maps. But we also have to be honest and clear about how we practice. So when I work with people mentoring one-on-one, I always ask them to describe to me what their practice is like. And so that we just have to like really dedicate some time and to really try them out and to see what is true or useful for you. Because, you know, I work with a lot of different students, and every person I work with has a different practice because they have different experiences. It's not a one-size-fits-all type of thing here. It's way too complex for that. And it's really, really arrogant for me to assume or to even think about what kind of practice you should be doing without us having a conversation first, because I don't know what your internal terrain is like. But you do. You know what it's like in there. And the more you're able to vocalize what it's like in there and work in some sort of capacity, whether it's a good friend or a mentor or a teacher or even the teachings themselves, is that we're always reflecting back to what's happening. And it all rests in the idea, if what you're doing leads to well-being, keep doing that. If what you're doing leads to suffering, stop doing that. But that's not so easy, is it? Because a lot of the strategies that I engage in, this is what I'll talk about mostly tomorrow, is that addiction is this moment where I'm going to seek out short-term relief, knowing that the long-term consequences are going to come around the corner. But in that moment, we oftentimes choose short-term relief. And this is also our culture. I know that this is Canada, but you guys are probably similar to America. You're just not half as bad as we are. But this cultural addiction around immediate gratification. I just want to feel good now. I'll just put it on the credit card. I'll just eat it. I'll just smoke it. I'll just drink it. I'll pay it off next month. But right now I want the thing that's going to make the thing feel like a better thing. right? And that's really what Buddhism's asking us to do, which makes it so hard, is trying to have some renunciation of like, don't. To some degree, we're choosing not the immediate gratification. We're choosing some skill or quality that says, you know what? I'm not going for the immediate gratification. I want long-term happiness and well-being. And if that means I got to sit with myself in a difficult moment, if that's what it's going to take, I'll do it. Because I know and I believe that this is the direction I want to go in. And so this metta vipassana is about seeing clearly, understanding the limitations of our humanity, and then bringing into that a sense of humility or kindness or friendliness or whatever word works for you, but you get the idea. And if that starts as a baseline for your practice and a foundation for your practice, that is a really, really great foundation to actually build a whole lifestyle around. And I think that's a very humanistic thing. Humanistic quality has nothing to do with Buddhism or religion or any spirituality. It's just about dealing with your own humanity. So I offer this for your reflection. I thank you for your attention this evening, and I want to have some time, as we do have some time, for any questions or comments you have about anything that I've said. So thank you very much.